Welcome to this podcast on current issues within the charity accounting world. My name is John Callidine. The big news, of course, is that we now have a new Charities Act 2011. The Charities Act 2011 consolidates previous charity legislation into a single comprehensive act. It replaces most of the Charities Act 1992, 1993, and 2006, and all of the Recreational Charities Act of 1958. However, it does not replace the sections in the Charities Acts about fundraising, which have not yet taken effect, that is, charitable collections in public places. What is important to note is that the 2011 Act only replaces the existing legislation, and it does not make any changes to the law. Therefore, in preparing accounts and independent examinations, audits, etc., reference is now made to the Charities Act 2011 on all documents used on or after the 14th of March 2012. It does not matter as to what financial period you are reporting on, it is the date of signing the certificate. Therefore, as you are now listening to this podcast, you should be signing off all your reports, certificates, etc., by referring to the various clauses in the Charities Act 2011, even if you are still dealing with 2011 financial statements. There is a get-out clause. Apparently, documents will still be valid if you accidentally refer to earlier acts. You do not have to go back and change any documents you have already finalised before the 14th of March 2012. In relation to independent examinations and section numbers, the examination is in place of an audit now under section number 144, subsection 2. The examination of accounts is made under section 145. The examiner follows directions under section 145, subsection 5, subsection B. The charity keeps accounting records under section 130 of the Act, and the accounts comply with the requirements of the 2011 Act. For unincorporated charities, the accounts are prepared under Part 8 of the Charities Act 2011. One hopes our software providers are up to date with all of this. One area I do get involved in a lot is the formation of new charities. Because of the staff cuts of the Charity Commission, this has now become a much more streamlined process. I note that from the 1st of March 2012, the Commission have stated that it is compulsory, when submitting new registration applications, to attach all the documents at the same time, along with the application form. Therefore, the governing document, the trustee's declaration, bank statements, and other supporting documents have to be submitted in the first instance. Bank statements being important, showing that the charity has monies within an account to fund the charity going forward. This can be a difficult issue, as of course many charities need to be formed before the funds will arrive. One way of dealing with this is to produce letters promising funds and submit this with the application. In some ways, it is almost a chicken and egg situation. We continue to await further news about the charitable incorporated organisation. As always, much has been promised, but nothing as yet finally delivered. Although my understanding is that spring 2012 is now the date for implementation. One of the more interesting aspects, that is, if you have the time in the charity world, is to read the Charity Commission reports that follow their investigations into certain charity activities. There is one case recently where a Footballers Supporters Training Development Trust, set up for charitable purposes to provide leisure and recreational facilities for young people, made a loan to its affiliated football club. The football club subsequently got into financial difficulties. The Commission then considered whether the loan was a lawful exercise of the charity trustee's powers. Not surprisingly, the Commission concluded that the charity had not met their legal duties and responsibilities, including the need to safeguard the charity's funds as applying to funds for proper purposes of the charity. This is a warning to all charity trustees as to what can go wrong, even when you have good purposes at heart. Do listen to my podcast on this subject of charity trustee responsibilities. This brings me to public benefit. Public benefit has been in the news again recently, with two cases having been brought to a tribunal hearing. The first one was brought by the Independent Schools Council, ISC, challenging the Charity Commission guidance on the public benefit requirement. In October 2011, the tribunal issued its decision in that case. Since then, a further case has been held in the Upper Tribunal in November 2011, looking at benevolent charities, which support restricted groups of beneficiaries. The importance of these two cases is that they bring a legal basis to the understanding of the public benefit requirement, following the Charities Act 2006. There was an 1891 tax judgment, known as the Pemsall case, which put charitable purposes under four headings: the relief of poverty, the advancement of education, the advancement of religion, and other purposes beneficial to the community. This, of course, was updated by the Charities Act 2006, with the addition of the new heads like the advancement of health, environmental matters, community, etc. However, the 2006 Act did not offer any particular definition of the term. It simply stated that any reference to public benefit is a reference to public benefit, as that term is understood for the purposes of the law relating to charities. It is, of course, very important that accountants, auditors, and independent examiners have an understanding of the public benefit requirement in dealing with financial statements. The 2006 Act requires charity trustees to have regard to public benefit guidance when exercising any relevant powers or duties. Likewise, any decision which a trustee takes in relation to charitable funds is governed by financial matters and public benefit. Indeed, the 2006 Charities Act brought the public benefit reporting requirement into the annual report for the first time. So how have these two cases added to the debate on public benefit and the definition of charity now to be found in Section 1 of the Charities Act 2011? The first case, of course, was about whether a fee-charging school would or would not be a charity, and how many bursary places, that is, free places, would a fee-charging school have to offer in order to be sure it met the public benefit requirement and therefore operating properly as a charity. The judge confirmed the principle that charity cannot exclude the poor even if it is an educational charity and not a poverty charity, and the judge agreed that when the school charges high fees, this would exclude the poor. But they concluded that a non-trivial provision by the trustees to enable children from poorer families to benefit would be sufficient to meet the public benefit requirement. This could be through the provision of means of set bursaries or working alongside state schools. The judges felt that a 10% level of bursary was almost certainly sufficient, but not 1%. This has meant that the Charity Commission has to withdraw some of its existing guidance about public benefit and fee charging schools, and we await the new publication from the Charity Commission in March 2012 on this subject. The other case was concerned with charities for the relief of poverty, and whether certain charities would be too narrow to be classified as for the public benefit, that is, charities set up specifically by employers for the benefit of their employees and not the general public, or charities for members of an organisation or particular family. Charity Commission have taken a cautious approach on this and have argued that the removal or the presumption of public benefit in the 2006 Act meant that a poverty charity with a limited range of beneficiaries were possibly no longer charities. However, the Charity Commission have now accepted that their view was not the only possible interpretation. The tribunal decision is still awaited in this case, But it seems unlikely that the tribunal will conclude that the 2006 Act will require benevolent charities to make any major changes. Therefore, as you can tell from what I've said, it seems that the law on public benefit has changed little. Those particularly in the political world who wanted a much tighter public benefit test, particularly in relation to fee-paying schools, have not got their way. I now come to gift aid. HM Revenue and Customs Charities Division have updated the guidance on gift aid declarations and provided new model gift aid declaration certificates. There is one for past, present and future donations, one for sponsorship and one for a single donation. There is also on the website a new checklist of the minimum information that must be included in a declaration if the charity decides to use its own declaration form. This minimum information being 1. The name of the charity or the community amateur sports club. 2. The donor's name with at least one initial. 3. The home address with a postcode. And 4. Whether the declaration covers present, past or future donations. A statement or verbal confirmation that gift aid is to apply, and confirmation that the donor has been given an explanation they must pay at least as much UK income tax or capital gains tax for the year of the donation. A sponsorship form is quite useful because as well as being used for gift aid, it details a record of the sponsorship gifts. It is interesting to note that spouses and people living at the same address can make a joint declaration, in effect making two or more gift aid declarations on the same form. Both donors must be individual taxpayers, and the declaration must include the full name and address of each person. Joint payments should be split equally between the donors, unless both parties tell the charity or the community amateur sports club how they want their payments to be split. Oral declarations are acceptable, and a charity may choose to keep an audible record of these. If they do not, then they must send the donor written confirmation of their declaration. The oral declaration is not effective until you send this written confirmation, being the same information as would be required on a gift aid declaration form. Finally, the latest proposals for the future of UK financial reporting were published in January of this year, which will apply from January 2015. The most radical change is the move away from the three-tier financial framework previously proposed. Indeed, we will have one single reporting standard now called the FRS. A new FRSSE called the FRSSE will also come later. The previously proposed FRSPBE, Public Benefit Standard, disappears as a separate standard, and its proposals incorporated into the new FRS standard. Thank you for listening to this podcast.